The oldest trick in the media theorist's book is the claim that it is only when technology's normal functioning breaks down that we become aware of the workings of our tools and infrastructure. Whether it comes in the philosophical guise of the Aristotelian slogan that the accident reveals the substance, in Paul Virilio's continental language of an original accident, where the invention of the car produces the accident on the highway, or in the post-Heideggerian phenomenological tradition, where the being of your lectern hits you because the lectern is set up too high for you, there is doubtlessly something productive about this line of thinking. Perhaps not as a general heuristic to gain a deeper understanding, but at least as a way of directing our attention. We only think about network coverage once the connection drops. We only think about the audio setup when the speaker is really hard to hear. But there are of course different reasons why the speaker is hard to hear. Me not closing the window prior to recording this is very different from the video chat platform suddenly lagging, or the tinny quality of the laptop microphone, and we experience these discordant expectations differently. And shifting expectations are key to what we want to discuss today. Because if the glitch is the unexpected break in the experience of technology, we need to think about how quickly our expectations have changed in the course of the pandemic. To make sense of this, we need to distinguish between a glitch and medium-specific noise. Rosa Menkman, in her book The Glitch Momentum, offers a handy definition. I quote, "I describe the glitch as an actual and or simulated break from the expected or conventional flow of information or meaning within digital communication systems that results in a perceived accident or error. A glitch occurs on the occasion where there is an absence of expected functionality, whether understood in a technical or social sense. Therefore, a glitch, as I see it, is not always strictly a result of a technical malfunction." End quote. This distinction between a technical and a social absence of functionality is not always entirely straightforward. We might blame the university's shoddy internet if the speaker lags, but roll our eyes at them if they fail to unmute again and again. But perhaps we might also be annoyed at them because why are they using the shoddy internet connection for an important presentation? Surely this wasn't the first time it was proven to be unreliable. Because a glitch has this momentary, unexpected dimension to it, complementing the concept of the glitch with that of medium-specific noise might help us make sense of how we relate to a speaker being really hard to understand. It is not very useful to describe the sound of an internal laptop microphone as a glitch, because it works exactly as expected. But we might find ourselves wondering why the speaker hasn't upgraded their microphone yet. What types of disruption do we chalk up as being glitches? How do we relate to expected and unexpected disruptions differently? What do we expect of the technology and the humans using it?
During the pandemic, I found myself preoccupied by the strange window onto private lives that was opened up by the ubiquity of Zoom calls. Extracted from my office, the only one I'd ever really had to myself, suddenly finding myself sitting at my living room table with a chair that made my back ache after as little as 15 minutes, I was struck by the range of circumstances in which friends and colleagues continued their work during this crisis. In this sense, it left me thinking about the digital interaction of the pandemic, both as a reflection of, but also a contributor to, inequalities within the academy. These could be seen and heard in new ways, which we think are worthy of exploration and analysis. Any discussion of inequality during the pandemic has, we think, to begin with the recognition of the relative privilege of academics. My favourite expression of this comes from the organisational theorist Martin Parker, who wrote how, like an acid eating away the flesh, COVID-19 has allowed us to see the bones of the social structure, to unveil the inequalities that mean some have to travel to work in care homes and fruit picking fields, while others self-isolate and edit books. He's certainly correct in this, and it's a point which can't be repeated often enough. Even at the height of the pandemic in April 2020, the Office for National Statistics data shows that only 46.6% of UK adults worked from home. Exposure to risk certainly reflected existing inequalities, but we want to add, so too does the precise way in which someone is relatively insulated from them. Many of these questions are quite familiar ones. Who has caring responsibilities? Who has access to a private workspace? who has reliable internet access which can sustain simultaneous users, who has relatively up-to-date computer equipment, who lives in an area which is relatively quiet, who feels professionally and financially secure during a time of crisis, who is required to come into work, and how much influence do they have over their conditions. These were fault lines within the academy which obviously pre-existed the pandemic. They were exposed but also entrenched by the decentering of the campus brought about by the pandemic. But what we're trying to explore in this project is a more subtle manifestation of them, one which we think has yet to be sufficiently analysed. Who has the time, energy and money to invest in broadcast quality equipment? Who has a quiet space in which to work, free from external noise and domestic responsibilities? These are the inequalities which manifested subtly but strikingly through the mediation of Zoom calls, in how clearly we are seen and heard by others, not in the figurative sense in which we talk about visibility and influence in a sphere like academic social media and the stratification that gives rise to, but very literally in how we are perceived and how we carry or fail to carry, with the implications this has for our capacity to win and keep the attention of others in mediated interaction. This is a new fault line of digital inequality amongst and between academics, and it's one which we think is worthy of further conversation and scrutiny. Did you have the same feeling we sometimes get when you open the audio file and it's almost unlistenable? The starting point for this project was a shared fascination with the widely divergent quality of audio, which we found in academic exchange during the pandemic. After we discussed this theme over a number of weeks, we each recorded a monologue in which we experimented with different inputs and assorted background noises in order to demonstrate the variability of sound quality. We rarely hear these transitions within an example of someone speaking, with the exception of, say, a passing car and other fleeting background noises, as opposed to there being a feature of how we perceive differences between people's voices in a mediated setting.
So one of the questions is how these expectations that we have of the audio quality or of the way a conversation should sound or a monologue should sound in these mediated settings, they are framed in key ways, I think, along generational lines. Generational claims are always, you know, complex. I'm thinking about the fantastic work of Leopoldina Fortunati and her colleagues on the distinctions between older millennials and younger millennials in terms of technical savvy. So the big three, boomer, millennial, and zoomer, is probably too wide a conceptual net to capture the truly important phenomena that we want to talk about. But for the sake of discussions, let's not overcomplicate things or rehash some introductory Karl Mannheim debates and just say, you know, generation as a certain age cohort that comes to have a social significance because it constitutes itself in a social, cultural, or political identity, something along those lines. And I do think our expectations are very deeply shaped by the social significance of the presumed generational identity of the teacher, the student, the speaker. So I think this is something that we talked about, Mark, right? The reaction we have to a boomer doing the whole, oh, how do I share my screen spiel, is very different to a much younger person where we generationally expect them to have grown up more online.
And I think this raises the question of the expectations that we brought with us, using the term we in inverted commas, as we entered this new world of ubiquitous Zoom interaction. Because, of course, we can break down that we, because this was more new to some of us than to others. It might have been an occasional part of our lives. It might have been a regular experience. It might have been something we've never done before. And the way in which we talk about things like knowledge production, scholarship, scholarly interaction, they tend to collapse these distinctions. And so I like what you're saying, because I think it opens this back up and lets us think about the experiences that led each person to have certain expectations. And as you say, generational or even just socio-demographic patterns in where those expectations came from. You raised the point when we talked about this previously about things like Twitch and the way in which Twitch stream will tend as a genre to be glitchy and more loosely or unscripted. And what that means for expectations of not just quality, but also the style of presentation in audio video.
There's one way in which the generational levels of expertise involved manifest in almost counterintuitive ways. So I think the level of technical skill in producing audiovisual content that a significant percentage of younger people have is frankly quite stunning. And I'm not talking about pro or semi-professional content creators, but, you know, just people sharing videos, photos, voice messages. And that's perhaps the counterintuitive bit. I think that leads to somewhat lower expected standards of skill, because they know how long it would take if you try to capture the perfect voice message without stutter, how hard it is to light yourself, to have the light wrap around your face perfectly. And so I think things that wouldn't be acceptable even as a rough cut in a broadcast media context are entirely expected and acceptable in an online context. So there's no need to redo a take because there's a car in the background, because you stutter or mispronounce a word. The production is quick because it's not a bloody work of art, but a fairly ephemeral form of communication, right?
And when you see it through this light, some of the expectations that get uncritically reproduced in the online education discourse, particularly that came during the emergency online pivot, become really obviously problematic. The assumption that, as you've pointed out, gets repeated endlessly, that audio and video content has to be of a certain very short length. And neither of us would deny that that can sometimes be appropriate and sometimes can be useful. But the idea that it is uniformly to be expected because of some imagined generational characteristic where listeners of a certain age will switch off after a certain point. Certainly that could be true as an empirical generalization in some contexts, but it seems obviously inadequate as a guide to practice. And this is why we're trying to open out these discussions and some of the assumptions that are being brought into these exchanges. You know, to put it very bluntly, why is short form video regarded as axiomatic? And what work does this do in terms of the kinds of educational content that people produce? And also the kinds of content they don't produce as a consequence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, during the pandemic, this was always my argument, and I entirely agree with you here, right? Just go to the art section on Twitch, you know, where hundreds of people are literally watching paint dry for hours, and tell me again how the youth has no attention span, right? So I think a week on Twitch should be probably included in any form of teaching training. And it's quite cool to see that there is a bunch of literature on this kind of already or emerging. But I think we also shouldn't be too quickly here, because we know, and there's also been tons of research in this, how crucial the production of parasocial relationships are to this type of media consumption. And I'm not saying that this is unique to Twitch or even digital media in general, but we do have to consider if the particular type of PSR that this model relies on is one that we actually want to take into the teaching setting. So, I mean, both on the level of principle, right? Do you want a parasocial friendship between learner and teacher in a university setting? Would this be a good thing, or should this be a place to maybe practice different kinds of relationships, but also on a very practical level, and following the topic of our discussion, if we expect teachers to rely on that kind of relationship for their teaching, different people will be in very different positions to navigate this. I mean, sorry, that's obvious, but, you know, what kind of divides are we buying into? I think this would unfortunately be probably highly gendered, right? Beginning with the fact that becoming too approachable puts very different challenges to one's status as an expert along gendered lines. And of course, the well-known issues with maintaining public-private boundaries and so on.
That's hugely important. And there's a parallel here to academic social media, particularly academic Twitter. And many cases that I've heard about and seen, in some cases seen firsthand, Where the imagined proximity, the imagined closeness that interaction with students on Twitter gives rise to led to an informality that actually created problems. In a few cases, I can think of quite serious problems. So I think we have to tread very carefully with that. But I wonder if we could think about the improvisational and the dialogical and what that does. And can that be detached from parasocial relations, at least as an objective, in order to think about how we can focus on not the transmission model, which underpins a lot of educational video, but the exchange of thoughts, seeing ideas in motion, as the philosopher Daniel Little once put it, which is a phrase that stuck in my mind because it captures something. There's something engrossing about seeing thought develop and hearing thought develop between people in real time. To see the backstage of knowledge production rather than just the front stage, to see the process rather than just the outputs. It might be that's more appropriate to postgraduate level education than it is to undergraduate level education. I think it should be part of teaching at all levels. It has a place, and I think it opens up a much more creative, engaging, and less fixed approach to educational video and educational audio.
Absolutely, and I think this is perhaps also one of the aspects that we want to draw attention to with a little project we're doing here, right? Because there is something much more engrossing about a dialogue than it is about a monologue, or at least that's been our experience of it. And I think this is partly it, right? Because you see thoughts being developed, you see thoughts in motion. You're not having somebody who is presumably very smart explain things to you, but you actually see people trying to understand something and trying to work through it. And I mean, there is the negatively connotated reading of this as a form of interpassivity, I guess, right? That you see people think so you don't have to. But I'm not sure that's entirely true. At least it's making things too easy. And I think these are some of the dynamics that we're hoping to draw out by juxtaposing a monologue and the dialogue, right?
And it leaves me wondering if dialogues and their mediation, they can carry some of the energy in social interaction that I think tends to get lost through mediated communication. I've been thinking a lot about Randall Collins's neo-Durkheimian idea that there are certain modes in which energy is created and transmitted through chains of interaction. And my experience has been that's very difficult to do online. That I can come to teaching online in a good mood and I can leave it in a good mood. I can come to it in a bad mood and I'll leave it in a bad mood. But the transformative experience of teaching, the sense you're connecting with people, that you're doing something together, that you're sharing something and inhabiting a shared intellectual space. My experience has been that I just don't feel that in the same way online. And in parallel to that, I find it much harder to improvise online. I script a lot more when I talk online, because I find it very difficult to settle into and inhabit a connection with other people where you're talking with them, not to them or at them. And it's interesting, I hope, the way in which we've tried to play with this and to think about the implications of this, including for the digital divides in the academy, because there's much more going on here than just the style of delivery. But what we've tried to draw attention to is how the form has an impact on this. About who can command and win the attention of others, who can sustain an engaged relationship with others, and the role that what we've talked about as glitching and as medium-specific noise plays in this.